We also have a couple of articles related to how hospitals are dealing with the increased load, and a story about how fewer than half of Americans are likely to comply with another lockdown, as the polling shows. And I'll also have a section related to the economy. We haven't spoken about the economy in several days. One article about how commercial real estate losses threaten the entire recovery of America's economy. And then two articles related to the oil and gas industry. I'll also read a piece about how plague history shows how a pandemic's course can be shaped. And finally, an interesting story about how puzzle businesses are going bonkers as people seek pandemic pastimes at home. First, we'll look at the numbers. From today's Odessa American, Ector County total cases, both confirmed and probable, 7,804. And by the way, these numbers were last updated on Tuesday afternoon from Ector County. Ector County negative, 28,963 out of 37,273 tested, with 506 pending, 125 deaths. Recovered, 6,002. Active, 1,677. ECISD daily cases, 12 students, 6 staff. Midland County, 6,213 confirmed, 103 deaths. From the Texas Tribune, average new cases increased in Texas by 1,407 cases compared with the 7-day average a week ago. On November 11th, 10,097 new cases were reported. Hospitalizations in Texas increased by 907 patients compared with a week ago. As of November 11th, 6,779 Texans are hospitalized for the coronavirus. Average new deaths in Texas increased by 9 deaths compared with the 7-day average a week ago. On November 11th, 141 new deaths were reported. West Texas Intermediate is once again trading up $41.58, and that's up 13 cents. Now here are coronavirus briefs. Just 1 week after the United States reported more than 100,000 coronavirus infections in a single day for the first time, that milestone is already starting to feel quaint. Wednesday's jaw-dropping tally of 145,835 new cases set yet another record, the sixth in just 8 days, as the number of people hospitalized nationwide topped 65,000 for the first time since the pandemic began. Nearly 10.4 million coronavirus cases and over 241,000 fatalities have been reported since February in the U.S., according to data tracked by the Washington Post. More news about a potential vaccine could be coming soon. Moderna said Tuesday that it has collected enough data for an independent monitoring board to determine whether its shot is effective. Checking temperatures failed to identify coronavirus infections among Marine recruits, according to a new study. The findings suggest that the safety measures introduced at many workplaces are not particularly effective, especially when compared with routine testing. Black and Asian people in the U.S. and Britain are at higher risk of coronavirus infection, a new report finds. At least 5 virus outbreaks in New Jersey are linked to Halloween parties, health officials say. Now here are some short articles. World Health Organization chief warns against pinning all hope on COVID-19 vaccine. From CNN's Simon Cullen. World Health Organization Chief Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus has warned against pinning all hope on a COVID-19 vaccine, saying people need to remain vigilant and take precautions against coronavirus. "We may be tired of COVID-19, but it is not tired of us," Tedros told the Paris Peace Forum on Thursday. "European countries are struggling, but the virus has not changed significantly, nor the measures to stop it. A vaccine is needed urgently, but we cannot wait for a vaccine and put all our eggs in one basket." Many countries in Europe are under lockdown conditions amid a second wave of infections. Several governments have warned that health systems will be overwhelmed if the number of new infections is not brought under control soon. Pfizer said Monday that its vaccine candidate was more than 90% effective, according to early results, news which was met with relief globally. But while Pfizer's news appears promising, significant logistical challenges remain in terms of distributing a potential vaccine. Head of U.S. Federal Vaccine Group says FDA might not make a decision on COVID-19 vaccine until Christmas. From CNN's Elizabeth Cohen. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration might not complete its review of Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine until Christmas, according to the head of the federal network coordinating COVID-19 vaccine clinical trials. Pfizer announced Monday that early data shows its vaccine is more than 90% effective. The drug giant says it could supply to the FDA for emergency use authorization soon after the safety data on the vaccine is gathered next week. Dr. Larry Corey, who runs the COVID-19 Prevention Network, which is funded by the National Institutes of Health, said he thought it would then take several weeks for the FDA to finish reviewing the vaccine's safety and efficacy data, as well as information about its manufacturing. "I want to set the expectation that this is a big decision," said Corey. Alex Azar, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, has said the process of getting FDA authorization will take several weeks, while Dr. Anthony Fauci says vaccinations will likely start a bit after Christmas. Corey pointed out that it took more than 4 weeks for the FDA to consider an application by Eli Lilly and Company for its antibody therapy. Lilly applied to the FDA for emergency use authorization on October 7th and received it on November 9th. "You can look at that timing as a marker," Corey said. "There's a lot of data to review." Corey believes it will take about 10 days for the FDA to review Pfizer's clinical trial data. The agency also needs to review Pfizer's manufacturing data. "I'm not sure how long that review will take, but it could be 2 weeks. I think that's reasonable," Corey said. If approved, Pfizer's vaccine would first be given to priority groups such as healthcare workers, the elderly, and those with underlying health conditions that make them more vulnerable to COVID-19 complications. Fauci told CNN on Tuesday that the U.S. likely will be able to start dispensing vaccines in December. He also told Australia's ABC network that vaccinations will start in December, very likely sometime a bit before the Christmas holidays. Fauci is director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, which created the COVID-19 Prevention Network last summer. Azar said Monday that the process of getting authorization for Pfizer's vaccine would be in the several-week time period. Fauci says the cavalry is coming, by the Washington Post's Kim Bellware. Around the United States, new cases are soaring, hospital beds are filling up, and some areas are mulling a return to restrictions not seen since the spring. But Anthony S. Fauci, the nation's leading infectious disease expert, reassured pandemic-weary Americans the outlook isn't entirely bleak. "Help is really on the way, if you think of it metaphorically. The cavalry is coming here," Fauci said during a Thursday morning appearance on ABC's Good Morning America. "Vaccines are going to have a major positive impact." It was an optimistic tone amid days of grim reports that infections continue to hit record levels. Cases have risen in nearly every part of the United States, prompting some governors and municipalities to consider reactivating stay-at-home orders. Already, many states have reinstated restrictions on restaurant and bar service and indoor crowd size at businesses. Asked if the United States is headed for a possible national lockdown, Fauci said it's still possible to avert such drastic measures if people take every precaution seriously. "The best opposite strategy to locking down is to intensify the public health measures short of locking down," he said, noting that lockdowns are hard on people both psychologically and economically. "If we can just hang in there, do the public health measures that we're talking about, we are going to get this under control, I promise you," he said. Analysis says vaccines have never been distributed equally. A coronavirus vaccine would be no different, history suggests, by Ruby Mellon. In April 1955, an announcement echoed around the globe. American virologist Jonas Salk had developed a safe and effective polio vaccine. President Dwight D. Eisenhower, with tears in his eyes, thanked the researcher for work that would save the lives of countless children. The political leadership in the country did not consider this to be an American vaccine, said David M. Oshinsky, a professor of NYU Grossman School of Medicine and author of Polio, An American Story. They considered this to be a vaccine made by American know-how and American brilliance that was a gift to the world. Polio was eradicated in much of the world decades ago, but wild polio transmission still occurs in a few countries, and nearly 50 years down the line, the tone has shifted. Amid the coronavirus pandemic, which have left more than a million people dead worldwide, the race for a vaccine gains new urgency every day. But some people can hope for a dose much sooner than others, depending in part on where they live, as countries turn to vaccine nationalism. New forecast offers grim projections of upcoming trends in coronavirus pandemic, from CNN's Shelby Lynn Erdman. As the coronavirus pandemic accelerates across the United States, conditions could worsen on the West Coast, in the Northeast, and in the mid-Atlantic states over the next several weeks, according to a new forecast from the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, CHOP, Policy Lab. The CHOP Policy Lab will begin releasing weekly findings from its COVID lab county-level forecasts on the pandemic, the lab said Wednesday on its website. It noted that hospitalizations, ICU admissions, and ventilator use are now rising in all 50 states. Growing cases. The model is predicting substantial growth in COVID-19 cases over the next 4 weeks in the Northeast and South through the Mid-Atlantic region, where dire trends previously seen in the Midwest have now set in, the lab said. The forecast noted that mitigation efforts in and around New York City and Boston have slowed but not abated an increase in hospitalizations and ICU admissions in the cities. The CHOP Policy Lab is also projecting significant case growth along the West Coast in major cities in California, as well as in Portland and Seattle, into mid-December. Fast-filling ICU beds. In every Midwestern state, COVID-19 patients are occupying more than 25% of ICU beds, the lab reported. In four states, Montana, New Mexico, North Dakota, and South Dakota, coronavirus patients have filled up 50% or more of all available ICU beds. We suspect that in many localities across these states, ICUs are near, at, or over capacity, the forecast said. The forecast also noted that in Wisconsin, one of the earliest states to see an explosive growth in COVID-19 cases this fall, may be nearing a peak in transmissions, but hospitalizations and ICU admissions have not yet stabilized. At least half of the 819 counties in the lab's forecast are seeing a testing positivity rate of 9%, a measure of how prevalent positive coronavirus cases are compared to the number of tests administered. U.S. hospitals approach crisis level as some reach capacity and others face threats of strike. From CNN's Kay Jones, Brad Parks, Alex Snyder, and Rebecca Rice. Hospitals in the United States are coming under immense strain as some reach full capacity and others face threats of strikes by staff. Mississippi's Department of Health announced Wednesday that the state's COVID-19 hospitalizations are on track toward the crisis level we saw this summer, warning that if changes weren't made immediately, there would be critical shortages of first-line care for those seriously ill or injured. Mississippi Governor Tate Reeves extended mask mandates for 15 counties through December 11th, according to a release from the governor's office. The Mayo Clinic Health System said its hospitals in the Northwest Wisconsin were full to capacity, with 100% of its beds filled in the region. It said that half of the intensive care unit capacity is occupied by COVID-19 patients, while 40% of regular medical surgical beds are being used by COVID-19 patients, who said it normally stay in the hospital 2 to 3 times longer than non-COVID patients. The public urgently needs to treat COVID-19 as the health emergency it is to prevent the healthcare system from being overwhelmed, the Mayo Clinic Health System said in a joint statement sent to CNN Wednesday. Approximately 300 hospital staff in the area are on work restrictions due to exposure to COVID-19, the statement added. While we are temporarily deferring elective procedures in order to free up beds for COVID-19 patients, the public needs to understand we continue to care for other patient populations in addition to COVID patients. We remain open for trauma, emergency care, and urgent care needs, the statement said. Meanwhile, at least 1,500 nurses in Philadelphia are on the verge of striking, according to a spokesperson with the Pennsylvania Association of Staff Nurses and Allied Professionals, PASNAP. The nurses feel they have been pushed to the brink by unsafe staffing that seriously undermines patient safety, according to the release. The frontline nurses at 4 Philadelphia area hospitals have taken steps toward a strike to protect their patients and themselves on the cusp of a second deadly wave of the COVID-19 pandemic, the release said. The nurses are seeking a commitment to safe minimum staffing levels from each of the 4 hospitals. CNN has reached out to Trinity Health, Tower Health, and Einstein Health for comment. As coronavirus soars, hospitals hope to avoid an agonizing choice. Who gets care and who goes home? By The Washington Post's Daryl Fears, Joel Achenbach, and Brittany Martin. The coronavirus pandemic is rolling across America like a great crimson wave. In Illinois, the rate of new infections is so high that a group of doctors sent an urgent letter to the governor. We're having to almost decide who gets treatment and who doesn't, said one of its leaders. In Ohio, the rapid spread of the virus has pushed the state health care system to the brink. Expressing deep concern, Governor Mike DeWine, Republican, vowed to enforce his statewide mask mandate and issued new restrictions on social gatherings. We can't surrender to this virus. We can't let it run wild, he said. And in Iowa, where a record number of new infections in a day coincided with a record number of deaths, the White House Coronavirus Task Force issued a dire warning about the unyielding COVID spread throughout the state. The number of new daily coronavirus cases in the United States jumped from 104,000 a week earlier to more than 145,000 on Wednesday, an all-time high. Nearly every metric is trending in the wrong direction, prompting states to add new restrictions and hospitals to prepare for a potentially dark future. Fewer than half of Americans are very likely to comply with another lockdown, polling shows, from CNN's Lauren Mascarenhas. Fewer than half of Americans say they are very likely to comply with another lockdown, despite growing concerns over the coronavirus pandemic, the latest Gallup polling shows. About 49% of Americans polled between October 19th and November 1st said they would be very likely to stay home for a month if health officials recommend it following a coronavirus outbreak in their community, down from 67% in the spring. While 18% said they were somewhat likely to comply, a third of respondents said that they would be unlikely to comply with lockdown orders, double the rate seen in the spring. Though Americans are less willing to stay at home, the results show they are more worried about the pandemic, with 61% saying they believe the situation is getting worse, compared to 40% in April. Political divide. The results show a political divide in those willing to stay home. About 40% of Republicans polled said they were willing to comply with the stay-at-home order, down from 74% in the spring. In comparison, 87% of Democrats said they were likely to comply, a slight drop from 91% in March and April. About 82% of people said they were confident in their ability to avoid infection, compared to 64% in March, which could play a role in Americans' willingness to stay home. Mask wearing. Health experts have said that mask use could significantly reduce the need for another lockdown. Only about half of Americans reported wearing masks in April, shortly after the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention suggested the practice for the general public. The number rose to 92% in July and now sits at about 88%. Now we're going to move to the economy. This is from the Washington Post. Mounting commercial real estate losses threaten banks and recovery. Big changes in downtown property values could cost banks and bondholders. Regulators are raising alarms. By David J. Lynch. Published November 11th. Buried in the fine print of Signature Bank's third quarter earnings was a hint of the financial storm that could be about to break over the U.S. economy. The Manhattan Bank last month set aside nearly $53 million to cover potential loan losses, largely due to the coronavirus pandemic's impact on the U.S. economy. Lending money to shopkeepers, landlords, and hoteliers in places such as Times Square or Soho used to be considered almost a sure thing, but that was before the contagion emptied New York City's skyscrapers, hotels, apartment buildings, and stores, leading the President of the United States to call it a ghost town and forcing some borrowers to stop making loan payments. Now, Signature, which has nearly 60% of its portfolio tied up in commercial real estate, is bracing for the fallout. The bank's bad loan write-offs, though still modest, are creeping higher. Despite years of steady profits, investors have punished the stock, which even after a recent rebound has lost 27% of its value this year. If U.S. banks absorb big losses on their $2 trillion in commercial real estate loans, the entire economy will suffer. Just the fear of looming bankruptcies and defaults has prompted banks in recent months to restrict new lending at a time when the virus-ravaged economy needs all the help it can get. Tighter credit standards make it harder for commercial borrowers to roll over old loans as they come due and could starve other businesses of capital needed to expand and hire more workers. If the economic downturn proves lengthy, mounting losses could even undermine financial stability, according to some Federal Reserve officials, economists, and credit analysts. This is something that could make a bad situation worse, said Adam Slater, lead economist for Oxford Economics in London. What we don't want is to get really nasty stresses and strains in the financial system from something like this. Today's worries are grounded in history. Banks have repeatedly failed after stumbling into big losses on commercial real estate loans, from the savings and loan crisis of the 1980s to the Great Recession in 2008. U.S. banks lost $110 billion on commercial real estate in the last financial crisis, at least one quarter of their total losses, according to Oxford Economics. This time, the losses could be even worse, with the pandemic forcing a fundamental reconsideration of how Americans work, shop, and live. With a highly contagious disease circulating in the country, tens of millions of people have been working for months from home, shopping online, and only occasionally visiting shops and eateries. If a coronavirus vaccine becomes widely available in the first half of 2021, people may revert to their old habits, but some societal changes may endure, especially if a vaccine takes longer to develop or offers only limited protection. Such shifts would make downtown office buildings, hotels, and stores less valuable, sending losses ripping through banks and bond investors that hold $3.4 trillion in commercial real estate debt. Office space, the largest single slice of the commercial real estate sector, already is seeing rents fall as vacancies rise. Property values eventually could plummet to 20 to 35%, according to a recent Barclays report. Hotels and retail properties have been hit even harder. Regulatory changes enacted in the aftermath of the 2008 crisis means banks now are better armored against losses, but more than a decade of ultra-low interest rates has also allowed financial risks to accumulate, which the pandemic is now laying bare. The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, FDIC, regards 356 banks as concentrated in commercial real estate, based upon criteria such as the ratio of their CRE loans to their capital base and the pace of loan growth over the last 3 years. Valley National Bank Corp. in Wayne, New Jersey, is the largest bank to exceed the regulatory guidance. Its CRE loan portfolio has grown to 81% in the past 3 years, according to S&P Global. We remain confident in our underwriting and believe we are well positioned to navigate the current environment from a credit perspective, Michael Hagedorn, the bank's chief financial officer, told investors last month. Community banks are particularly dependent on lending for commercial properties. These smaller banks get into trouble with these loans by growing too fast and expanding into geographic areas where they lack expertise, according to Bert Eli, a banking consultant. Banks that exceed the FDIC criteria were 3 to 4 times as likely to fail as other institutions during previous downturns, according to a 2019 study by the Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia. In the event of another crisis, most banks would be affected and many might fail, wrote economist Pablo de Erasmo, the author. The CRE sector remains a potential source of instability for the banking sector. In the second quarter, banks reported the largest percentage increase in charge-offs for bad loans since early 2010, according to the FDIC. They also quadrupled the reserves they set aside to absorb loan losses. I don't see any way of avoiding a great deal of pain in the commercial real estate market in 2021. It's almost inevitable, said Cam Fine, the former president of the Independent Community Bankers of America. My friends at the Federal Reserve and the FDIC are becoming increasingly uncomfortable with what's going on in the commercial real estate world. As the pandemic shock makes existing commercial properties less valuable because workers and customers are afraid to return to them, their owners will struggle to roll over their mortgages. Some will default, leaving lenders to absorb the loss and hobbling the economic recovery. I am especially worried about a second shoe dropping that will particularly affect small and medium-sized banks, which provide a large share of commercial real estate loans and small business loans, Rosengren said in a September speech. A curtailment of credit resulting from such problems has caused serious headwinds to recoveries in the past and may be a serious problem going forward. In the third quarter, Signature reported making $1 billion in new loans, a 75% drop from the previous quarter, though the bank says it has plenty of pending deals in the pipeline. And at this point, I'm going to stop reading this very lengthy article, but it does give us an idea of what's going on in the banking sector, which could affect the entire economy. Now we'll move to a couple of pre-recorded reports from the Texas Standard, again, economic-related issues, and related to an industry that's particularly important in our region, the oil and gas industry. The first report is oil and gas industry facing a sea change toward renewable fuels. And the second report is hydrogen is the oil and gas industry's next big bet. Here are those stories.
Last week, Royal Dutch Shell announced it would be shutting down its Convent refinery on Louisiana's Gulf Coast, leaving some 700 Shell employees plus another 400 contractors looking for jobs. It's just the latest example of how the pandemic has fundamentally reshaped the energy industry. The ongoing economic slowdown has seen some oil majors shift their operations, placing a stronger emphasis on renewables and other more environmentally friendly technology. With a wave of refinery closures happening, however, what does the future of a changing industry look like? Joining us now is Matt Smith. He's been thinking about this question as Director of Commodity Research at Clipper Data. Matt, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Thank you, David.
So we've seen those refinery plans setting to shut down in recent weeks. Shell, like I mentioned, also a PBF energy refinery in New Jersey. How much of this is COVID, and how much of this is part of a bigger sea change in your reckoning?
It's a bit of both, David. So as you mentioned there, there's been a lot of refineries, nearly 10 in North America, that have been targeted for a shutdown or to be idled since the start of the pandemic. So the situation is being exacerbated by the coronavirus. There's no doubt about that. You have refinery margins, which essentially measure the profitability of refining a barrel of oil into gasoline or diesel. They've been considerably lower this year simply because demand has been crushed. But the drumbeat is building for peak gasoline demand. So whether that's due to the behavioral changes we've seen this year in terms of working from home, or if it's technological advances due to greater fuel efficiency, or if it's simply just that move towards more electric vehicles, there is that sea change underway there, it seems.
Seems like this is, whenever you have one door sort of close, another door opens, the saying goes, and it strikes me that a lot of companies are now seeing this as a potential window of opportunity to think about alternatives.
Yeah, for sure. So some of these refineries are being reconfigured. So there's one in San Francisco, Phillips 66 refinery. They're not closed it yet, but they're looking to close it in 2023. And they will look to reopen it to produce renewable fuels. And so they're projected to be the world's largest renewable fuels plant. The same is being done as well. There's a Holly Frontier refinery in Shane, Wyoming. And that's being retrofitted at the moment to pivot. So there is definitely some momentum being built here for renewables.
When you say renewables, you're talking about like renewable diesel?
So specifically with that Holly Frontier one, it is renewable diesel. And what that is essentially is it's not a fossil fuel. It's made up of renewable resources such as natural fats or vegetable oils or greases. But it's the production of it that is making it renewable diesel, because you have these sophisticated refiners that are be able to refine it just as they would any other petroleum product, and so that's what they're looking to do there.
And I gather that's the main distinction from biodiesel, right? It's how it's processed, because renewable diesel apparently is highly processed, and so it doesn't you don't face the same challenges of freezing temperature and storage and all that sort of thing that you do with sort of more DIY solutions in biodiesel.
Yeah, exactly. And you do have a focus with renewable diesel as well. So from a global basis, a half of all global imports of renewable diesel go into the U.S. West Coast, which is, I think it's something like 15,000 barrels per day, something like that. It's not a small amount. And the reason that it's going in there is because of the economic benefits, because of California's low carbon fuel standard. And so there are already certain regions, those more kind of more environmentally friendly focused ones, that are already putting this renewable diesel to work, essentially.
Watch this space. Matt Smith does. He's Director of Commodity Research for Clipper Data. Matt, thanks again.
Thank you, David.
One of the hot clips from last week's debate between President Donald Trump and former Vice President Joe Biden was Biden's commitment to transitioning away from oil. But it should come as no surprise to regular Texas Standard listeners, because we've talked before about how some major oil companies themselves are shifting their focus to greener energy. It's especially happening with European oil companies, including BP and Royal Dutch Shell. Now, when we talk about green energy, we typically think of renewables, such as solar and wind, two industries where Texas is emerging as a power player. But as interest grows in reducing fossil fuel emissions, another fuel source is attracting interest and investments from oil companies: hydrogen. Here to tell us more is Energy Insider Matt Smith. He's Director of Commodity Research at Clipper Data. Matt, welcome back.
Thanks, Laura.
So how can hydrogen be used, and how realistic are its prospects?
Well, Laura, hydrogen can be used to generate electricity or power and heat. It's currently most commonly used at the moment in petroleum refining and fertilizer production, but is looking to be developed to be used by utilities and in transportation because, for the reasons as you mentioned, it burns far more cleanly than fossil fuels. It currently accounts for a very small piece of the pie in terms of the world's energy supply, sort of under 5%. But some of the more optimistic estimates peg it at meeting nearly a quarter of consumption by 2050. That's a very lofty expectation, but still one that is pretty impressive, really. But for that to happen, it's going to take government policies to essentially promote it, because it's higher cost than, say, natural gas, and it's likely going to be for a couple of decades. So it needs subsidies and tax credits to make it more cost competitive versus those fossil fuels.
But some oil companies are sort of already doing this on their own, or are these mm-hmm. European companies getting some nudges to do that?
Both, actually, yeah. So as big oil tries to pivot away from fossil fuels, hydrogen is emerging as the next big bet. So oil and gas majors such as Shell, Equinor and BP, they've spent tens of millions of dollars on pilot projects. And then you've got other companies in Europe such as Repsol, who's pledging to spend a quarter of its capex, its capital expenditures, on low carbon projects through 2025, so focusing on renewables and hydrogen. But at the same time as well, particularly in Europe there, you've got the support on a government level. So a country such as Germany has thrown $10 billion to this industry. So there is very much a push. But as you mentioned, like particularly with, say, Texas with solar and wind, they are kind of that go-to source in terms of the fight against climate change. Hydrogen burns extremely hot, whereas renewables such as wind and solar can't deliver quite that level of heat. So some industries, such as making steel or cement or chemicals, they need those extreme temperatures. And that's really where hydrogen has the advantage.
Now, this, I feel like, is a stupid question. But, growing up with chemistry classes, I'm thinking H2O, that's just water. And this is hydrogen and oxygen, but obviously this is some kind of different mixture. And it can be used to power everything, or at least eventually that's the goal?
Yeah, that's it. And so you get it via a couple of different methods. So one is essentially steam methane reforming, where you're getting natural gas to react with steam to produce hydrogen. And then you have partial oxidization, which is where you essentially combust that natural gas and you create the hydrogen with carbon monoxide or carbon dioxide.
Interesting. So what does the future of hydrogen look like? Is this just a trendy investment as energy companies are trying to look more, quote, green? Or is there real opportunity here?
There seems like there is real opportunity. There is just that kind of cost prohibitive element to it. There's a number of different stipulations, actually. They're broken out by color, essentially. So there's four different ones and really three different buckets. You have green hydrogen, which is made from renewable resources, and it's the most cleanest. And then in the second bucket, you've got blue hydrogen, which is when you're using natural gas or coal to produce that hydrogen, then you're capturing the carbon dioxide, because that's the issue, is that creation of the carbon dioxide. So if you can capture and store that, that's good for the environment. The final bucket is gray and brown hydrogen. The gray is natural gas used to produce hydrogen, and brown is with coal. But that resulting CO2 is pushed down into the air. And like with everything, really, the cleanest version of this, the green hydrogen, that's the most expensive one, while the least environmentally friendly one, the gray brown hydrogen with the coal and blue, is the cheapest. And so it all comes back to economics.
Matt Smith is Director of Commodity Research at Clipper Data. Matt, thank you for explaining all this.
Thank you so much, Laura.
They say those who don't know history are doomed to repeat it. This article I'm about to read is related to history and how it shows a pandemic's course can be shaped, by Amy Woodyatt, CNN. Plague outbreaks in London spread four times faster in the 17th century than they did in the 14th century, researchers have estimated after studying troves of wills and death records. Researchers from Canada's McMaster University analyzed thousands of documents spanning 300 years, including personal wills and testaments, parish registers, and the London Bills of Mortality, to search for patterns on how plague was spreading throughout the population. Plague, one of the deadliest bacterial infections in human history, caused an estimated 50 million deaths in Europe during the Middle Ages, when it was known as the Black Death. The disease, though rare and now treatable with antibiotics, is still around today. Cases have been recorded in China and the United States as recently as this year. There was a striking acceleration in plague transmission between the Black Death of 1348 and the Great Plague of 1665, researchers said in findings published Monday in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences Journal. David Earn, a professor in the Department of Mathematics and Statistics at McMaster and lead author of the research, told CNN that while plague cases in London doubled every 6 weeks in the 14th century, by the 17th century, they were doubling every week and a half. "That's an enormous difference," he said. But this was not simply a case of the disease becoming more virulent. Evolutionary geneticist Hendrik Poynar told CNN that while the spread of the disease accelerated, genetic analysis to date tentatively suggests that it may have become less infectious. "When there are shifts in the epidemiology of the disease, most of the shifts that occur can be translated to human intervention or things that go on outside of the actual genetics of the bug," Poynar, a professor of the Department of Anthropology at McMaster and a co-author of the study, said. "The estimated speed of the epidemics, coupled with what we know about the biology of the plague, suggested that the plague did not spread primarily through human-to-human contact during these centuries, but instead, growth rates for early and late epidemics are more consistent with bubonic plague, transmitted by the bites of infected fleas," the researcher said. Researchers believe that factors including the population density, living conditions, and cooler temperatures could go toward explaining the acceleration of the disease in London and could help with our understanding of modern pandemics, such as the current COVID-19 pandemic. "A given pathogen can cause very different epidemics, whether it's in the same place over time or in different places," Earn explained. "The characteristics of the community can strongly influence the pattern of the epidemic," he said. "And of course, the behavioral response of individuals can also influence the pattern of the epidemic," he added. The findings could also provide a blueprint to how the current pandemic and future pandemics could behave. "Plague never went away, and it won't ever go away. And SARS-CoV-2 will never go away," Poynar told CNN, explaining that the virus, like the plague, has natural reservoirs in the population. "Fortunately, we have a phenomenal scientific community, you know, across the globe, working, more or less together right now, to figure out a way to come up with antibody treatment, to come up with, hopefully, a vaccine that's effective for longer-term immunity," he said. But he also cautioned that pandemics will continue to threaten humans so long as people encroach on the natural world, something scientists and environmental organizations have repeatedly warned. "The reality is, if you think that this is the only time it's going to happen, you're fooling yourself, because it's happened repeated times in human history, and it's bound to happen again as we continue to encroach on lands, the same thing with climate change and environmental deconstruction. We're bound to run into more reservoirs that spill over into humans," he added. Now here's an article from the Washington Post. Families of sick COVID-19 patients may develop physical and mental symptoms of their own, by Charlotte Huff, published October 25th. The weeks of fear and uncertainty that Pam and Paul Alexander suffered as their adult daughter struggled against COVID-19 etched itself into the very roots of their hair, leaving behind bald patches by the time she left the hospital in early May. Tisha Holt had been transferred by ambulance from a smaller hospital outside Nashville to Vanderbilt University Medical Center on April 14th, when her breathing suddenly worsened and doctors suspected COVID-19. Within several days, her diagnosis had been confirmed. Her oxygen levels were dropping, and breathing had become so excruciating that it felt like her lungs were wrapped in barbed wire, as Tisha described it. Vanderbilt doctors put the 42-year-old on a mechanical ventilator, and the next few weeks passed in a blur for her parents, who waited helplessly for the next update about the eldest of their three children. "That's when it got really, really bad," Pam said. "We were not allowed to see her, to go, to talk to her. Not anything. I would call, and I might get somebody, and then again I might not." Later that first week, after Tisha arrived at Vanderbilt, Pam reached a nurse. She said, "Ms. Alexander, in all probability, your daughter will die today." "Me and my husband both, we just cried and cried. It was probably more than likely the worst day of my life when the nurse told us that," Paul said. "She was our first baby and the first person that I've held that was a part of me." The number of Americans hospitalized with the virus is increasing again, reaching 41,000 late last week, most with a circle of loved ones holding vigil in their minds, even if they can't sit at the bedside. A decade ago, critical care clinicians coined the term post-intensive care syndrome, or PICS, PICS. It describes the muscle weakness, cognitive changes, anxiety, and other physical and mental symptoms that some intensive care unit patients cope with after leaving the hospital. These complications are fallout from the medications, immobility, and other possible components of being critically ill. Now they worry that some family members of critically ill COVID-19 patients may develop a related syndrome, PICS family. Studies show that about one-fourth of family members, and sometimes more, experience at least one symptom of PICS family, including anxiety, depression, post-traumatic stress disorder, or complicated grief. Grief that is persistent and disabling when their loved one has been hospitalized, according to a 2012 review article published in the journal Critical Care Medicine. Daniela Lamas, a critical care physician at Boston's Brigham and Women's Hospital, believes relatives and friends of coronavirus patients may be particularly vulnerable. "Hospital rules designed to prevent the spread of the virus have robbed them of the opportunity to sit with their loved ones, watching clinicians provide medical care and gradually processing what's happening between physician updates," Lamas said. In pre-pandemic times, a nurse would explain what they had heard from the doctor and help them come to terms with unacceptable realities, she said. "The Alexanders could reach a doctor or nurse on most days, but not always," Pam said, acknowledging that they had a lot to do. Pam described trying to cope minute to minute, day to day, waiting for the next report from the hospital, wandering from room to room. "You just walk around in sort of a daze. You can't think of anything else but that." Paul struggled with feelings of depression, often retreating to his workshop. "I wouldn't do anything but sit there and cry. Wouldn't work on nothing. Just sit there with my head in my hands." Meanwhile, they had become temporary parents to their grandsons, two teenagers who had homework and laundry and kept asking about their mom. Pam tried to shield them as much as possible. "There are a lot of things I just didn't tell them until it got really bad," she said. Being physically cut off from their daughter was the hardest, Pam and Paul said. "I don't care if I had to put on 40 layers of clothes," Pam said. "Just to have gotten to go in and touch her and see her would have made a huge difference." Even though family members are typically barred from visiting during the pandemic, they can wrestle with guilt that they let a loved one down in his or her time of need, said Jim Jackson, a psychologist and assistant director at Vanderbilt's ICU Recovery Center. Without any visual sense of what's going on, people often move to worst-case scenarios. They move to catastrophic thinking, he said. And why wouldn't they? Because it's already a hugely serious situation, right? It's a 5-alarm fire, and they're not able to be engaged. Doctors and nurses can ease the strain on loved ones by updating a designated family member at least once a day, said Judy Davidson, a nurse scientist at the University of California at San Diego and an author of the 2012 Critical Care Medicine Review article. Arrange video calls, she suggested, so the family can see their loved one and better picture the room, clinicians, and broader hospital environment. If we don't protect them and keep them strong while the person is in the ICU, Davidson said, they won't be strong enough to do the caregiving that's necessary once the person comes home. After a patient does return home, family members may shy away from discussing what they have been through so as not to burden their still recovering loved one, Jackson said. The ICU survivor may remain silent for similar reasons, he said. What tends to happen is they both sort of passively agree not to talk about the elephant in the room, when that's exactly the best thing to do, Jackson said. Tisha, who finally left the hospital May 3rd, was stunned by her parents' appearance the first time she saw them. They both looked exhausted, and I was shocked at the amount of hair that they had lost, she wrote in an email. Treatment and damaged lungs have made it difficult for her to talk by phone. Since then, her parents' bald spots have begun to fill in, but they haven't released their worry. Tisha can breathe from only the top of her lungs and needs 24-hour oxygen, Pam said. She's not strong enough to return to work as a nurse, a job she loved. She no longer has health insurance and can't afford even the cheapest plan on the Affordable Care Act exchanges. To this day, Tisha doesn't know where she contracted the virus. Her parents spend virtually all waking hours at Tisha's home, about a 10-minute drive from their house, and check on her a few times daily, sometimes more if she's feeling poorly. I think, am I going to come over there and she's going to be dead from her heart not working? It scares me to death because she has bad days and good days, Pam said. Tisha keeps her cell phone handy in case they text or call. If they call and I don't answer, it sends them into a panic and they are apt to drive over here to make sure everything is all right, she wrote. She has been attending a virtual ICU survivor support group at Vanderbilt that Jackson helps lead. It's open to relatives, but Pam was unsure she could handle hearing others' painful stories as she's still processing her own. I don't mind talking to you about it, she said, but sometimes talking about it just sort of gets you in a funk. Their church community has provided solace, calling when Tisha was in the hospital and leaving food on the porch. Pam and Paul credit myriad prayers from loved ones near and far with bringing their daughter home. Even the doctors, they really didn't know why she was there either, to be honest with you, Paul said. Paul hasn't stopped fretting about his eldest child. I still can't turn it off. It hasn't turned off, he said. But every day is a blessing, though. That was provided from the Washington Post and Kaiser Health News. Finally, we're going to leave you on more of a lighter note. This pre-recorded story was from NPR from November 9th, and it's about how the puzzle business has gone bonkers as people seek pandemic pastimes at home.
Jigsaw puzzles have become a favorite pandemic pastime. The pandemic has been such a boon to the puzzle business, most retailers ran out of them. But as NPR's Elizabeth Blair reports, they're slowly but surely putting the pieces together again.
A few years ago, Matthew Goins, who is African-American, was looking for puzzles for his three children. When he couldn't find any images of people who looked like his family, he and his wife started the online company Puzzle Huddle. He says their number one seller is an image of an African-American girl doing a science experiment.
She has a chemistry set. She has two Afro puffs, and she's adorable. She has some lab glasses on.
And she flew off the shelves when the pandemic hit. Goins says with schools and daycare centers closed, parents were trying to keep their kids occupied, and puzzles were a go-to product. His inventory nearly ran out.
most of our best sellers got down to zero.
Puzzle Huddle designs and licenses artwork in the U.S., and the puzzles are manufactured in China. Goen says they started seeing delays back in January before the pandemic hit the U.S., but he says production is gradually coming back.
None of our factories returned at full capacity, ready to, you know, crank out whatever products we needed on the drop of a dime. They all kind of returned very slowly and methodically and with, you know, careful production rates.
It is sky-high demand and rock-bottom production.
Diane Skilling is the president of Suns Out, a California company that's been making jigsaw puzzles for 26 years. She says they sell puzzles to about 3,000 mid-sized retailers. They design or license the artwork, decide on the piece count, and hire contractors to do the printing and die cutting.
When you're communicating with the end customer, I think sometimes they think that Santa and his elves make puzzles and just drop them on the doorstep. In actuality, it is factories filled with big, big machines.
Making puzzles is no simple matter, says Brian Way, co-owner of the online retailer Puzzle Warehouse.
The kind of cardboard you have matters, how the picture is affixed to the cardboard, how it's cut. The reason there is a global shortage is because the manufacturing is so complex and so expensive that there's almost no new production coming onto the marketplace.
With the pandemic disrupting her supply chain, Diane Skilling says Suns Out is making big changes. She recently purchased 3 die-cutting machines. She says eventually they'll be able to manufacture about half of the puzzles they sell in-house.
So we're very excited, and next week we should have our first machine running. Our other 2 are due to come in right before Christmas, and I've told them I want big red bows on them, like the Lexus commercials. So we'll see if they do that for me.
To families who like to do jigsaw puzzles around the holidays, Matthew Goins and Brian Way say don't wait to the last minute to place your orders. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
That's our coronavirus update for this Thursday, November 12th, 2020, from the Recording Library of West Texas. I'm Michael, and coming up next, we'll be bringing you the national news from USA Today, followed at 3 o'clock with our 2-hour local news program. Here are some of the articles our volunteers have been reading today. From the Midland Reporter-Telegram, elections chief says MISD investigation will cover all districts. Local GOP leaders aren't acknowledging presidential election outcome. Ann Dixon experiences breakthrough moment at meeting with teachers. Railroad commissioner-elect has focus on education and transparency. From the Odessa American, tough talk on COVID at council. Memorial unveiled to Wilson and Young. And superintendent offers condolences. Those articles and more at 3 o'clock. And then at 6 o'clock, the Wall Street Journal with more national news. At 7 tonight, we'll be bringing you our Texas Monthly Archives program, the first broadcast of this week's show. And this week, we turn again to football. We'll have articles about the Houston Oilers and Earl Campbell. We'll have articles about Friday Night Lights and more. Once again, football articles for this football time of year coming up at 7 tonight on Texas Monthly Archives. We hope you'll join us then. Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, USA Today, followed by the Midland Reporter-Telegram and Odessa American at 3.
This is a Recording Library of West Texas community update.
When it's open, Midland County Public Library, 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday. Curbside pickup at Downtown Branch, 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. Monday through Friday.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland, Odessa area. It's 73 and clear. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low in the low 50s. Then, tomorrow, mostly cloudy with a high in the upper 50s. Tomorrow night, mostly cloudy with a low in the mid 50s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 2 p.m.
Hello, this is Melanie, and I'm reading articles from today's USA paper, Thursday, November 12th, 2020. Starting in the money section, and under the money line column, there's a couple of articles. First one, European Central Bank is wary of bumpy recovery. European Central Bank head Christine Lagarde warned Wednesday that the economy could face a bumpy stop-start recovery despite good news about vaccine development.